This is the concluding talk in the series of seminars this week. And I'm going to try to pull some of the threads that we have followed over the last days together. And I'd like to start with a parable, a Buddhist parable, that of the city. And it's on the first page of your handout if you have that. In this image, we find the Buddha giving a picture of his vision, what it is that he sees himself as doing. He says, suppose, monks, a man wandering through a forest who sees an ancient path, an ancient road, travelled on by people in the past, and he would follow it, and he would see an ancient city, an ancient capital that had been inhabited by people in the past, with parks, groves, ponds, and ramparts, walls, a delightful place. Then the man would inform the king or a minister and say, sir, know that while wandering through the forest, I saw an ancient path, an ancient road travelled upon by people in the past. I followed it, and I saw an ancient city, an ancient capital, with parks, groves, ponds, and ramparts, a delightful place. Renovate that city, sire. Then the king or the minister would renovate the city, and sometime later that city would become successful and prosperous, well populated, filled with people, attained to growth and expansion. To me, this has almost biblical resonances to it in a weird way. We're talking about the discovery of something almost by chance in a forest, something that has been destroyed, has fallen into ruins, and then the wish to rebuild the city, the ancient city that lies at the end of this ancient road. And the cooperative task involved, it's not just the one man who saw it who would set about rebuilding the city, but he needs to get the help of the powers of the day, the government, the king. And the whole community then sets about restoring this ancient city till once again it thrives, becomes prosperous, becomes well populated. This is the metaphor the Buddha is saying about how his own teaching might be seen. And so he goes on to say, and he says, in the same way, monks, I saw the ancient path, the ancient road, travelled on by the Buddhas or the awakened ones of the past. And what is that ancient path, that ancient road? It is just this noble eightfold path, appropriate seeing, thinking, speaking, acting, working, making effort, practicing mindfulness, and practicing concentration. And I followed that path, and by doing so I came to directly know aging and death, craving, its cessation, and the way of eight branches, the eightfold path itself. In other words, although it sort of tails off towards the end, the image is quite clear. The road is the Eightfold Path, and the Eightfold Path in this image does not lead to nirvana, the cessation of suffering. On the contrary, it leads to the equivalent of a city. And the city, in the analogy, is compared to the practice of the Four Noble Truths themselves. Exactly what we looked at yesterday. And if we remember, the four truths are not four things we believe in and hold as doctrines which are true, but rather the four truths are a complex set of interconnected tasks or actions. The fully knowing of our existential condition, of dukkha, of birth, sickness, age and death. The letting go of craving, of grasping, of clutching onto this, of getting rid of that, of trying to manipulate our world according to realize our self-centered desires. And in the letting go of that kind of craving, moments in which that craving stops, moments of openness in which we enter into a path. And that path is once again the Eightfold Path. So we see a similar pattern, a similar structure here, as in the structure of the first sermon, where the Buddha starts by saying he has awoken to this Eightfold Path, this middle way that avoids extremes, and then he immediately describes the four truths, and then he describes them as actions which are to be recognized, performed, accomplished, and through doing that, one can then begin to speak, or he can begin to speak, of having acquired a complete awakening in this world. So the Eightfold Path leads to the four truths. We find the same pattern in other texts. If you look at the structure of the fifth book of the Sanyutta Nikaya, which I suspect is something you do on a daily basis, it called the last two sections, are Sotapatti Sanyutta and the Saccha Sanyutta. In other words, the entering of the stream or the entering of the path, and that is followed by the reflection and the practice on the four truths. So we have the path that leads to the truths, and as we pointed out yesterday, those truths also include the path which leads to the truths, which also includes the path which leads to the truths. We find, as we saw also yesterday, this holomorphic picture. Holomorphic means like a hologram. In a holographic image, you can take any particular point in that image and you find the whole thing. The whole image is contained in each point. We find this in the Mandelbrot sets and fractals and so on. It's very much, a very, very beautiful way of understanding the creativity and the emergence of life itself. And so what we have here is the Four Noble Truths as the template or the framework within which something equivalent to the rebuilding of a city takes place. So here we have a picture of the practice of the Dhamma, which is not concerned, at least initially, with escaping from the cycle of birth and death, transcending this world of suffering and change and conditions, achieving nirvana, but rather we see a rather secular vision, a vision in which the Buddha sees his path as leading to a way of life that, if practiced not only individually but communally, collectively, by the society, can begin to lay the foundations of a new way of being in this world, a new kind of civilization. Remember, civilization is based on the Latin word civitas, city. It's a city. There are other resonances of this idea when the Buddha speaks of the middle way that avoids the dead ends or the extremes of sensory indulgence on the one hand and religious self-mortification on the other. The extremes, perhaps, of the world or worldliness, and on the other hand, the extremes of religion. And the middle way is one that finds a path that doesn't get lost in either of those extremes. And in describing those extremes, he uses the word gamma. Gamma means village. He says these two dead ends are like, in America you'd say they're hick-like, village-like, somehow limited to a life of repetition and toil. I mean, nowadays we've rather romanticized living in the country, but try and imagine what it's actually like for the vast majority of people on the planet. It's hard work. And it also means that you have very little time for much else. You're tied to the seasons, you're tied to the cycles of the year, the cycles of growth, of harvest, and so on. There's something very beautiful about that. But it's striking, therefore, that the Buddha somehow sees his teaching, his practice, as leading us beyond the limitations of a sustenance existence based on agrarian livelihood, and moving towards the greater complexity and differentiation that is possible in the more complex organism of a civitas, of a city, a complex society in which people are able to diversify in their activities. It's not getting up at dawn and going out into the fields. Some people practice commerce, others practice healthcare, others practice philosophy or religion. There is a life of the mind, and the possibilities of each person are enabled to become more distinct. One can follow one's deeper intuitions as to how your life could develop and evolve in a distinctive way. The complexity of the networks of relationship in a city allow for more diversity of human experience and human development. Something is probably lost, a relationship to the land, a relationship to nature. That, of course, is also true. But the point I think the Buddha is trying to make is that what he envisions is not just a spiritual path that leads to some kind of personal liberation or well-being, but rather he sees his practice as establishing another way of life in this world, a way of life that is not grounded on acquisition, is not grounded on the protection of what one is attached to, is not grounded on fear, but is somehow grounded on a way of life that is no longer conditioned by those drives. There is a freedom made possible in these teachings that is not just a freedom for the sake of freedom itself, liberation, but a freedom not only from certain restrictive and constraining habits, but also a freedom to, a freedom to realize other possibilities, a freedom to develop one's capacities, one's potentialities. So often this idea of liberation or freedom is somehow set up as a kind of icon, something that we aspire to, something in which we project all of our deepest longings, to be free. But the Buddha is very clear, and I think Buddhist tradition has been pretty consistent here, that there is nothing in this world that somehow exists in and of itself. Freedom is always and only can make sense as a freedom from something, or a freedom to do something. Freedom per se doesn't really mean much, if anything. The same, of course, I've already pointed out with this idea of awakening or enlightenment. It's enlightenment about something, awakening to something. It's always within a framework of relationships. It's not about trying to somehow rise above or go beyond conditionality or contingency to achieve some kind of transcendental liberation from all things, but rather to find freedom, to realize freedom, and to practice freedom within the network of relationships that we call life. And I think this image illustrates this very, very clearly. So the Buddha, I feel, is pointing to another kind of world that might be possible in this world. And for this reason, I'm particularly interested in following this particular line of thinking within the Buddha's teaching. It's not, I have to admit, the dominant way in which Buddhism is presented, or even if you read the suttas, these kinds of images do not come up that often. There's much more emphasis on the cessation of suffering, on going beyond the cycle of birth and death, of no longer being reborn, of escaping this world of turmoil and change and pain. But here we have another picture. The Buddhist canon is very diverse. There are lots of different narratives and discourses, and I think its richness lies therein. I'm not saying that this is what the Buddha really meant. I don't know whether that question can even be answered. But I think what we can see, and history shows this as well, is that we have a source, a resource of materials, of ideas, of practices, of images, of parables, out of which we can forge a path, out of which we can hear voices that are speaking to our condition now. And each time the Buddhism has gone into another social or cultural or historical period, it has had this capacity to reimagine itself. When it went into China, it became Chinese Buddhism, it became Zen Buddhism, Pure Land Buddhism, things that didn't exist in India. The core ideas are similar, but the way in which the Dhamma is configured, the way in which it's reorganized, is appropriate to the situation in China in the 2nd, 3rd, 4th centuries of the Common Era. Same happened in Tibet. He went to Tibet much later, in the 8th century, and then later in the 11th century. and it managed somehow to adapt itself to the specific conditions of Tibet. And that's why Tibetan Buddhism is so different from, say, Japanese Buddhism. So the Dhamma, the Buddha's teaching, these practices, are not a set of dogmas and truths that have to be preserved intact and cannot be changed, and we have to just preserve them. Remember, the only things we preserve are things that are already dead. If you preserve an apricot or a peach, you put it in some sort of syrupy liquid or alcohol, and you kind of preserve it, but there's nothing living anymore. And we can understand, you know, especially if we take the Tibetan situation, this is a society now in diaspora, which we, in here in Israel, of course, we know very deeply from your history, and there is an importance for preservation. That is how the culture remains what it is. It survives. But there's the danger is that it becomes somehow perhaps rather self-regarding, rather insistent about its own preservation above all else. And perhaps the vitality of Buddhism can sometimes get lost when it's simply seen as something we have to preserve unchanged from the past. History shows us that the Dhamma has a high degree of flexibility, adaptability. It has, and remember, we sometimes think that the Dhamma has been something that has been practiced in what we call the East. And we lump India, China, Japan, Tibet as though that's just the East. But India, Indian culture, is as different from Chinese culture as it is from European culture or Mediterranean culture. Very, very different. The fact that Buddhism was able to successfully translate itself into China is already an example of having made an enormous cultural leap. And it shows the possibility that such differences, such radically different cultures, can both adapt these ideas in ways that speak to them. And that, I think, is useful to bear in mind, particularly as we, or as I, as a Western European of the 20th and 21st centuries. I find when I read some of these texts that they're not artifacts of an ancient culture or civilization, that they somehow speak to my condition right now. There's something almost shockingly contemporary when I read some of these texts. Not all of them. I could have read you out a bunch of texts from the Pali Canon that you probably wouldn't have related to at all. But there are many passages that seem to jump off the page and somehow look me in the eye, as though I'm being somehow addressed by them almost personally. And that, I think, is the mark of any great culture, any great civilization, is that it speaks beyond the conditions in which it was born. If I read Ecclesiastes, I don't know how you say that in Hebrew. Many, you know, Ecclesiastes or the book of Job, Yof. This is not something that only speaks to the Jewish people. It speaks beyond any particular group. It speaks to the human condition as such. It addresses our universal experience of birth and sickness and aging and death. And the same is true with some of these Buddhist texts, not all of them. A lot of Buddhism is still, I feel, very much embedded or caught in the ancient cosmology of India. The idea of rebirth, the idea of karma. I wonder very much whether these ideas are really exportable. They may be fascinating, but they seem to belong to another epoch, another age, another time, another culture. Whereas there are so many other teachings, and I think the more central ones, like those of the Four Truths, and obviously the things I've been singling out in my talks, that speak beyond anything to do with Indian cosmology or classical Indian beliefs. They're addressing the human condition. In other words, my condition, your condition. But it requires, of course, a process of transformation, a transformation within myself to really understand what they might mean. And in that process, the Dhamma or Buddhism will likewise undergo changes and transformations. But that should hardly be surprising in a tradition that is going on ad nauseam, endlessly, about how everything is conditional, how everything changes. Sometimes you feel that Buddhists are saying, everything changes except Buddhism. That's going to stay the same. But our historical consciousness, which is very much a feature of our, you know, post-Enlightenment, that's the European Enlightenment, worldview, is one that's highly alert to the contingency of historical processes and events. And we see this very much also in the Buddha's understanding of the person, the human person, the self. And we spoke yesterday in the questions about this very basic idea, this idea of not self. And this is probably one of the notions that's given rise to the greatest amount of confusion in the Western understanding of Buddhism. It's very often said that the Buddhists don't believe in the self. There is no self. Anatta, no self, see? No self. But that's not true. The idea of anatta, of not self, is simply a way to consider our experience and to notice that nowhere within the body, the feelings, perceptions, inclinations, consciousness, can there be found something that corresponds to this notion I have of me. And nor can we find this me or this self existing apart from body, feelings, perceptions, and so on. Self is not equivalent to the sum of its parts, and self is not equivalent to something that somehow stands outside those parts. In ordinary language, we say, I have a body, I have a mind, I have perceptions. And the bewitchment of language that Wittgenstein spoke of suggests very strongly that there is an I that has a body, there is an I that has a mind, as though it is a thing. But of course it's not actually like that. When you look deeply into your experience, this I, this me, this seemingly solid point of reference, is unfindable within any aspect of our organism. And then if you take the organism away, there's no self left there either. We only know who a person is because of their body, because of their thoughts, because of their identity, their history, their memories. Take all those things away, and where is this person? This is getting a little bit philosophical. I'm not going to go very far down there. But the point is to open up our experience in such a way that we are less and less stuck inside this fixed sense of ego that seems to be partless, indivisible, permanent, constant, and somehow a little nugget of something. But that doesn't mean there is no self. It means that the self is not a thing that is reducible to this or that, or that exists in any isolation, but rather the self is what we call this story, this process of being an embodied creature. The person is therefore also impermanent. The person is something that evolves according to conditions and actions and choices. And it's in that sense that there is that it is not self at the same time. There's nothing fixed there. Now, a very good example of this is found in verse 80 of the Dhammapada, which is one of the best known collections of verses attributed to the Buddha, where he says, just as a farmer irrigates a field, just as an arrowsmith fashions an arrow, just as a carpenter shapes a piece of wood, attanam dhammati pandita. The wise person, the sage, tames, as one tames an animal, tames the self, tames himself, herself. Now, the imagery here is not the imagery of there is no self. The self is that, or oneself is that which is tamed, which is worked. And the images the Buddha gives to describe that are images taken from the everyday world of work, farming, fashioning arrows, making arrows, sculpting or carving a piece of wood, something very hands-on. In other words, he's comparing the person, or the self, or the I, he's comparing it to a field. He's comparing it to an arrow. He's comparing it to a block of wood. Things that are worked. In the case of the field, you have a barren field, a barren tract of land, that you begin to cut channels through it. You irrigate it. You allow it to receive water. Again, an image that keeps on coming up, water. By irrigating a field, and again, a kibbutz like this, started basically with a barren piece of land that was then irrigated. And plants and trees and grazing grasses for animals were then able to grow. The community was then able to flourish. Again, it's a bit like the image of creating a city, creating a community, a place where people can thrive. And the person is a bit like that too. In this analogy, the Buddha is suggesting that the untamed or the undeveloped or the unevolved person is a bit like a barren field. Nothing much grows there. Nothing much is produced. Nothing thrives or flourishes. Again, there's a very, very strong image here that the purpose of one's life is to flourish. The Greeks have a word, eudaimonia or something. Sometimes it's translated as well-being, but apparently it literally means something like to flourish, to thrive, to grow. It's an image of life. So how do we flourish as persons? as individual beings. The Buddha is suggesting we need to do something similar to irrigating the system, irrigating our bodies, our minds, our thoughts, our feelings, our perceptions. What does that mean? How do you irrigate a brain? Irrigate. Irrigate means to cut channels with water that will then flow through it. To water, let's say. I think what we're doing in meditation is, in fact, like irrigation. We are opening up channels in our experience, in our lives, that allow, if we want to use this word, allow energies to flow in another way. Or maybe simply allow energies to flow. The trouble is, most of our irrigation channels are particularly good for the thriving of attachment and hatred and fear. So that when we encounter a situation, often our immediate reaction is one that triggers aversion, attraction, confusion, selfishness. They're the channels that are most deeply cut inside our neural networks. The practice of mindfulness, the practice of concentration, the practice of loving kindness, all of these things that we're speaking are in a way like digging new channels of life within ourselves. And so this practice, which at some times feels rather repetitive and boring, is in fact like digging an irrigation channel. So that the more that we do it, the more we in a way become accustomed to responding to the world mindfully, with a focused way, in a caring way. So we deliberately cultivate these channels. I mean, nowadays there's been research done into the plasticity of the brain that has found that uses exactly the same images. It's as though we open up new neural pathways. Pathways, same idea, channel. A space in which energy can flow without impediment. So that to be mindful and so on becomes more and more a spontaneous thing we do. Spontaneity basically simply means that that's the way our energies most naturally flow. And we may notice over time that we cease to be such an angry, uptight, negative person. And we become a more attentive, caring, positive, responsive person. And this is about the cultivation of the person. This is possible because the person is not a fixed thing. You are not you in eternity, luckily. But you are a configuration of events, of conditions, and you have the capacity for change. And this is what I think gives not only us, but our world, some hope that things can be done differently. We don't have to keep going round and round in the same cyclic, repetitive, habitual behavior. The self or the person is also like an arrow. When you think about it, each of these images is quite distinctive. An arrow is something that is put together with different elements. You have the head of the arrow, the pointed bit. Usually it's metal. You have the staff of the arrow, in other words, the straight piece of wood. And then you have the feathers, what is called technically the fletching, at the end of the arrow that enables it to be, as it were, aerodynamic. So you put these very different things together and you construct an arrow. Now an arrow, if it's well constructed, can be directed unerringly onto its target. So the Buddha seems to be suggesting that in the cultivation of self, the cultivation of the person, we're trying to organize our lives, put ourselves together in such a way that our life can focus more directly and clearly upon the realization of its values. We don't sort of swerve around like this, but our lives become more single-pointed, more purposeful, more directed. And that is something that is the result of our own practice, of our own way of life. It's about a reconfiguring of the person. This doesn't mean, of course, that you become someone else. I'll always be Stephen. But Stephen can develop. Stephen can change. Stephen can develop, can evolve, can become more directed, can become more flourishing, can become like a rich field rather than a barren field. And then the image of the block of wood, you know, just a hunk of wood, which has no intrinsic value or purpose until it is worked by a carpenter or a sculptor, and it is shaped and it is fashioned so that it becomes a roof beam or a door or a cup or a table. And the same with ourselves. We too can become more differentiated. Our lives can begin to assume a more meaningful pattern, a more meaningful shape. But it's not just going to happen by itself. We need to apply ourselves to these tasks. So the idea of the practice is very much the idea of creating something, of bringing something into being. Something which previously did not exist is brought into being. It's created. We're giving birth to something. And this is the word the Buddha uses in describing the Eightfold Path itself. The Eightfold Path, he says, is to be cultivated. The word in Pali is bhavana, which is rooted in the idea, in the concept of being. Bhava, bu, to be. Same, it's a cognate of the English word be. To bring something into being. The path is to be brought into being. It's not something lying in front of you where you passively walk along it. At that point, the image of the path breaks down. The path that we're speaking of here metaphorically is the opening up and the cultivation of a free, unimpeded space within ourselves. Every moment, every day, we are somehow challenged to open up this creative space within us. And here I think we find the roots in Buddhism for what we would call creativity. It's a creative process. We are literally creating something. We're giving birth to something. This also has social implications. For the Buddha, in contrast to the Indian culture of his day, the person is not defined in their role by birth. You're not born into a class or a caste that fixes you for the rest of your life. In ancient India, the idea was that when the world was created, the unformed Brahman or divine, in its first phase of emerging into diversity, became what is called the Mahapurusha, the great person. And this great person then fragmented. The head became the priests, the arms became the ruling class, the Katya, the Kshatriya, the body became the merchants, and the legs became the workers. And the practice in his day was that your dharma was your duty to fulfill your role in the divine scheme of things. So if you were born as a worker, your practice was to be a true worker. The Bhagavad Gita, where Krishna is persuading Arjuna to fulfill his role as a warrior, not to feel, you know, hesitant about killing people. You must fulfill that role that is divinely given in your life. The Buddha breaks with that and introduces the idea that a person is not defined by their birth or their race or their ethnicity or anything that is somehow innate, but rather the person is defined by their actions. And so we have this famous verse in the Sutta Nipata where the Buddha says, by action, which is karma, by action is one a farmer, by action a craftsman, by action a merchant, a servant, a thief, a soldier, a priest, a ruler. In this way, the wise see karma, see action as it really is. They see conditioned arising, understanding the results of action. So what you are is the consequence of what you do, not a consequence of some kind of fixed inner identity. So again, the self, the person, is created, is formed by what we think and what we say and what we do, the choices we make, the tasks that we accomplish, the skills that we achieve. Through acting, we create and we cultivate ourselves. In modern philosophy, this is called a performative conception of self. Performative. And again, it shows also the meaning of not self. If you were really a fixed identity from day one, there'd be no possibility of change. If you were a partless, permanent me, how could that possibly transform? How could it possibly act? How could it possibly evolve? The person is impermanent, is like a story that's unfolding, and we have a responsibility and a freedom to affect the course of that unfolding. And this same image, this same idea, informs the Buddha's vision of the kind of society he sees as possible. He compares it to an ocean. He says, just as the great rivers, and in his day that was the Ganges, the Yamuna, the Brahmaputra, and one other I forget. Just as these rivers flow into the ocean and lose their identity as rivers, the Ganges flows into the Bay of Bengal, and the Ganges vanishes, is gone. It's merged with the ocean, or the Indian Ocean in this case. And in the same way, he says, the different classes and castes of men and women, when they enter my Dhamma Vinaya, my teaching and training, they lose their identity as priests, as warriors, rulers, merchants, and so on. That class identity is lost. And once one is entered into that ocean, entered into his community, one is free to create oneself according to one's own vision. And so he says that just as the ocean is permeated by the taste of salt, so is my teaching permeated by the taste of freedom. This is not just a spiritual freedom here, but in context, it has to do with personal autonomy. It has to do with the freedom to become yourself, to create yourself. And at the same time, oh, I'm running out of time. At the same time, he also gives images of the person, images of the self, which are, not so fluid, not so much like water. He describes a person who has grasped the Four Noble Truths. He says such a person is like a pillar, 16 feet high, half of which is buried in the ground, and half of which stands above the ground. In other words, this practice of the Four Truths, which is another way, a more complex way, of describing the process of personal transcendence, transformation, and change through encountering suffering, through letting go of craving, through stopping and creating this path, that this process is also granting you a kind of rootedness, a kind of existential weight, so that when the wind blows, you are unmoved, you are not shifted from your ground. These ideas of change and evolution are also have to be seen in contrast to these images of rootedness, groundedness, a kind of solidity in the ground itself. Whereas he said a person who is not grounded, in this case in these four truths, is like a tuft of cotton, little piece of cotton, wool, or a little piece of kapok, the stuff we put inside these pillows. So as soon as the wind blows, you're taken off by it. You're whisked away. You're lacking a kind of existential rootedness. And if you think, if we again develop this idea of rootedness, it's like a tree. A tree is able to flourish and grow and be strong because its roots are deep in the soil. And that, I think, is the same with this kind of practice. As we cultivate these qualities, mindfulness and so on, it's as though we're putting roots into the soil. We're touching our ground. We're delving into the very heart of our own bodies, of our relationship with life itself. And that rootedness, which I think is symbolized by the pillar that is beneath the surface of the ground, is what secures our life on earth. So a tree can then, again, flourish, can thrive, can grow. And I think all of these images give us a clue, perhaps, as to what a more secular Dhamma or a secular Buddhism might look like. It's one that is entirely concerned with living a life in which we flourish on this earth, in which we open ourselves to the suffering of this world, not just our own suffering, the suffering of others. And as we see it now more and more, the suffering of the ecology itself, the suffering of the whole ecosystem, which is now risking pollution, perhaps even severe catastrophic dying. And here I think this idea of fully knowing dukkha extends beyond just humans and animals. It extends now to the whole biosphere. To be open to the suffering of the world means something else for us now. And this is a very, very deep challenge. How, as a human community, can we respond to that in a way that will make a difference? And I'm not going to suggest that Buddhism has all the answers. It doesn't. I think this obviously will have to be a collective endeavor. We'll have to forget our differences and somehow work together in this world if we're to respond to the suffering of the world itself. But I'll leave that here, and we'll have another concluding reflection tomorrow before we break up. And of course we can explore this further in the discussion this afternoon if you wish. Thank you.